One day, I shall come back. Yes, I shall come back. Until then, there must be no regrets, no tears, no anxieties. Just go forward in all your beliefs and prove to me that I am not mistaken in mine.
Welcome to episode 0.4 of the Sawtelle Show, entitled, I'm Not Tired, I'm Just Resting My Eyes. As always, we start with the news.
What's been going on in Sawtelle, Ruben?
Well, let me see. I mulched some sugar cane. That's old news, though.
We all know about that.
There was the enrollment night at the on the Czech campus for all the high school students, which I know about because I took my homeschool son along there to see about enrolling in a government school, which was interesting.
Okay.
But it was improved somewhat because C.D. Bragg was doing the slideshow.
Nice.
He was sitting behind the curtain.
He was the technical expert.
Yeah, he was the technical expert.
He was the man behind the curtain. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Yeah. So he had lots of wacky pictures of students doing wacky things with Walking on Sunshine as the soundtrack. It was good. It was actually pretty much the same format as the one the previous year. I'm getting to be an old hand at these now because I was at the one last year too. What else has been happening in Sawtelle? There hasn't been much surf. It's been very flat out there. Evan's reported. He's been down doing the surf report for us.
Okay.
He goes out to check out the surf and he comes back looking very grumpy saying, it's flat. And flat as a milk pond, he told me this morning.
So right.
He's missed something in his education there.
Well, I think a milk pond would be flatter. There's been a greater degree of viscosity in the liquid there.
Well, if there was some thirsty milk drinkers around, it might get quite rough out there.
A bit choppy. Has he seen any whales?
No. Yeah, I haven't asked him, though. But he hasn't mentioned any whales. Okay. You'd think it'd be more choppy if the whales were swimming past, because They might stir up the water a bit with their tails.
Yeah, I've been very, very slacking going for my walks. My walks are supposed to take me up to Taormina and then down by the creek and then around the headland and back to Sawtelle, but they generally only get me as far as the Taormina Hotel, and then I get too tired to do the rest of the way and I just take
perfectly
the same route back.
The Taormina Hotel is a terrible magnet.
It is. Once you go there, I mean,
you can't
tear yourself away.
Well,
from
if
the place.
You tried to leave, they'd punch you. You know, they wouldn't let you go.
It's very difficult negotiating the entry and exit because you can't look at anybody
in the eyes,
or else you're asking for it.
That's right.
A few things have happened of note lately that I dug up from rereading the microblog post for the last month.
Too much time in your hands, Matthew.
Yes. It was a embarrassingly effusive piece about Sawtelle in the Sydney Morning Herald on Saturday.
Yes,
did
yes,
you see
yes,
that?
Yes, I did see that. I think it was actually, didn't they just reprint it from that one they did 5 years ago when I moved down here?
No, well, they might have done, but they actually did have a fellow come and visit at the expense of the Chamber of Commerce and some tourism body or something.
We bribed someone.
Essentially, but we it didn't quite go according to plan because he rocked up at the caravan park, which I don't know if the caravan park is quite the accommodation in the middle of winter that's going to show off Sawtelle to its best advantage
to a posh journo from this big city.
Yeah, but apparently he turned up on the first night and they wouldn't let him check in until he'd forked over some cash. And wouldn't listen to his argument that no, it's all been arranged. So he had to fork over some cash and then spent a night in a van with a one-bar radiator to keep himself and his family warm.
Excellent, good. Well, I'm glad to know we're treating them right. We don't want to get, you know, too comfortable.
But despite all that, he wrote a piece praising Sawtelle to the heavens and Fig Restaurant and Creekside Inn, amongst others, got a plug.
I believe that we'll be returning his children soon.
Yes. Now that it's printed.
Yeah, now that he's printed the nice article about us, we can return his firstborn. he'll get the rest of them when he follows it through with a nice article describing Taormina and what a delightful holiday spot it is.
The Raj Mahal in Woolgulga. I cannot say Woolgulga. Can you say Woolgulga?
Don't they just call it Woolly?
That's probably the way to get around it.
Woolgulga.
Whoopi.
The Raj Mahal at Woolgulga.
Yes.
They're going to be serving supermarket food soon, aren't they?
They, if all goes to plan, it'll be a Coles.
Oh, and Keith and Arkin will be filling their wallets.
The brother-in-law of John Arkin will be the principal beneficiary of it, apparently. And it's caused quite a stir because he voted to approve the development application when he should arguably
he should have abstained. Because he had an interest. Yeah, it's a very disappointing news.
Yeah.
And I voted for Arkin. Sorry, Paul. I could have voted Paul, but I did actually put a vote in for Arkin and have my hopes up, but that's very disappointing.
Yeah.
It's politics though, so it could just be some kind of a exaggeration of, you know, he could have made an honest mistake, I suppose.
I don't know. It's the sort of thing where you'd have to know how it would look.
Yes. I mean, he'd have to be pretty naive to have made that kind of a mistake.
Yeah,
I don't know the whole story.
But yes.
I know that I won't be voting unless for him again, unless I, you know, get some kind of smack around the head.
Yeah.
Because, it's a very disappointing news.
But far be it from us to impugn the reputation of a councillor.
Well, I'm quite happy to impugn their reputation because I'm quite sure they'd be happy to impugn mine if they got half a chance, you know. If I actually come to think of it, I don't really have a reputation, so that's all right. You know, I'd impugn it myself if I had one.
The other thing that came to light was a blog.
Oh, Hugh Saddleton.
HughSaddleton.com.au.
I've been putting little comments on his blog.
Good.
Rather snarky ones, actually, lately. First of all, I started off all friendly, saying how wonderful... you know, another local blog of for local people, you know, and
it's a local blog for local people.
Yeah, we don't
there's
want anyone else.
For you here.
But then I very quickly got sick of every single post being from some mysterious person called admin. But the posts are quite often quite obviously letters or emails or smoke signals or possibly written in lipstick on the bottom of a shoe and posted through his window. And then posted on the blog. So he didn't actually write them. They're by different authors. But he or she or it, admin, whoever admin might be, admin, has posted these messages.
And
I think a blog should be more of a two-way communication. I'd like to know who I'm talking to.
It seems odd because someone was telling me that he used to actually run a... honest to God, printed on dead tree.
Ah, but you see, this is all rumours.
Newspaper.
How would we know? He's not told us.
This
is Hugh Saddleton. I mean, I want Hugh Saddleton to come along and have a chat with us.
Okay.
Or Hugh Saddleton can just post on his blog and tell us who he is.
We'll try and organise that. Because, you would think a newspaper person with some experience would appreciate the importance of having the byline and... not necessarily naming your sources, but at least saying who they are. Source close to so-and-so or, officials
like
within the such-and-such department.
I'm not quite sure the format he's trying to take. I mean, the name of the blog, Hugh Saddleton, suggests that it's just Hugh Saddleton's personal blog. But then you can see when you go to the blog that he's interested in local government matters and local news and local people. But then... He doesn't go into enough information in his blogs, in his blog posts, saying who sent this information in and there's a, I don't know, everything starts to annoy you. Once a few things bug you, then lots of things start surfacing. So, but other than that, you know, it's a nice, clean looking blog. Got nice pictures of Coffs Harbour. There's no reason why it shouldn't work.
The gift of linking different topics. So I should have taken the last thing you said and said, speaking of, and managed to let it run into the next thing instead of just going,
That's what editing's for, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, this is where I raid the freesound.org for little sound effects.
Well, you just cut it out. You did a great job of our little practice run that time, cutting out little bits. And there was one bit, I think, for about 20 minutes I was saying, it's on the tip of my tongue. And you cut out the whole thing and made me look intelligent. It was quite wonderful. I was nervous about that. And then I heard it and I thought, my God, I actually sound like I have remembered that off the cuff rather than after waiting for you to prod me and remind me and answer the phone in the middle of it. And
the amount of ums I removed.
Maybe we could actually name our episode numbers with a little point and then the number of ums afterwards. So this could be episode 1.46, for instance. And the next one can be episode 2.59, depending on how many ums we have.
Right.
It'll confuse people for a long time, but it'll entertain us endlessly.
Yeah, you've got to come up with some silly numbering.
And it'll give you something to do when you're editing it. You can count all the ums.
Bradley Kuhn at the Software Freedom Law Center podcast numbers his episodes in hexadecimal.
No, that's just nerdy.
That is nerdy.
I think we should number ours in Klingon. Because that's not nerdy.
Not at all. It's weird, Star Trek. Star Trek is the enemy.
I quite enjoyed our conversation in the pub the other night when Cameron, Paul and I all got a Star Trek reference. We're talking about it and you were just rolling your eyes in sheer embarrassment, which just made it all the more fun. I wish Sherry had been there, actually, because she would have joined in too. She's quite good at Star Trek.
So, speaking of Star Trek, something that isn't Star Trek is the Sawtelle Chili Festival, which, depending on how quickly I can edit this together, is either just coming up or has just happened, and wasn't it fantastic?
That was a very good connecting sentence there, so congratulations. Ruined it now by saying that.
Don't draw attention to it.
Oh, okay, well, let's move along.
Pay no attention.
The Chili Festival, yes. Well, I was thinking of coming dressed as a Klingon chili-covered warrior, but I don't think I will.
It looks like it's going to be a good one this year. The woman in charge is really on top of it.
There's been some good publicity for it, actually. I've seen a few, you know, editorials where they've mentioned it.
It's been in all the local papers. It was mentioned in that story in the Sydney Morning Herald.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's looking like it's going to be a very exciting day. I'm particularly looking forward to the cheese stuffed, crumbed, deep fried green olives that have been a feature of the last few chili festivals and are absolutely eye-rollingly divine. They don't have any chili in them, but they do have cheese in them, and they're deep-fried.
You see, I spend most of my time, when the chili festival's on, if I actually bother to remember to go to the chili festival, because I'm a bit slack, I'm afraid, I normally come down and I wander up and down the street looking for anything that doesn't have too much chili in. Because I remember the first year, I think I decided to go. And I like spicy stuff, but when you put chili in things like chocolate, I mean, you deserve to be deep fried, really. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's ruining two good things. You know, chili's great, chocolate's great. You combine the two and they're ruined.
It depends on how you do it.
It doesn't depend how you do it.
We've had a chili chocolate mousse from what? From the restaurant that was Fig, before Fig was Fig, if you understand what I mean.
Yes, I do.
Before Lee took it over.
But it was Fig then too.
I can't remember what it was called. I don't think it was called Fig.
It was called Fig, and briefly it changed its name, and then it went back to being called Fig again.
Okay, it might have been in that time when it briefly changed its name. But one chili festival, they did a chili chocolate mousse, which sounds revolting, but the main taste is chocolate, and you just get a slight tingling warmth following through.
That's probably the trick. And I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, because I've had that Belgium cherry beer,
mm.
which was beautiful. And then I had one again another time, which was disgusting. And it made me... You might be right.
But if you can get the chili and the chocolate together in such a way that you just... You initially taste the chocolate, then you get that warmth carrying through, and your mouth slowly gets hotter and hotter and hotter. And then you have to take another spoonful in order to damp down the chili with an extra chocolate hit. That just...
sounds very tasty.
That becomes the...
Think chili's a sweet thing, though. I just think that's silly.
No, I can't do sweet chili sauce anymore. After...
Oh, no,
the late 80s, early 90s, where it was overused to a ridiculous degree in pub food.
Yeah.
I can't even look at sweet chili sauce unless it's...
Well, I'd never came across Thailand. Sweet chili sauce until the mid-90s when I came to Australia and somebody introduced it to me, and I thought, well, it's just like tomato ketchup, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Only with chilies instead of tomato. Sorry, any other news you can
think of? Well, after the Chili Festival in Sawtell, the Chili Festival was having a Latin dance party or something, which I was invited to. But fortunately, I can't attend. Fortunately, because I can't dance. I have to go to the Janison Short Sharp Film Festival at the Jetty Theatre, which is going to be a very interesting night.
I should probably go to that. We went to it last year, and... We had lots of friends putting films in, and there were some great films. One particular friend, he did a excellent Lego Star Wars film. So, you know, ultimate YouTube geekiness there. A young lad, and it was really good. He did a great one. So, and he won an award for that one.
Well, not to blow my own trumpet, my chums Megan, Mark, Fiona, and David, their film, The Movie, which I played the pivotal role of. Fat bloke in a devil costume.
Oh, is that going to be on?
That's in amongst the finalists.
I'll have to go and see that one. Can I hide a video camera in there so I can just get a shot of you dressed in your devil suit?
Yeah.
I think we need a still of that one, actually. On this, when you post this blog, you could put a little still of that.
Okay.
Just there, of you in your devil suit.
Yeah, you have to post the still because blink and you'll miss it, fortunately, because I did look rather ridiculous.
I still have that in burned into my retina.
Yes.
I glimpsed it for one moment when I was round here that night when I was very drunk and I don't remember anything. So I woke up in the morning with a picture of you in a red devil suit, and I wondered if maybe I'd done something sinful with you the night before, and I thought, no, it must have been a movie.
Yeah.
Or a strange dream.
Yes. So also in the finalists is the movie where I actually had a speaking part, The Boy Next Door, which was,
excellent.
If I say so myself, one of the classics of modern cinema. And also one of my filmmaking chums, Peter van Schellebeck, I'm sorry, Peter, I can't pronounce your last name, who's just moved down to Sawtell. He was living in Coffs, so he's now a Sawtellian, so we can root for him. He's got a film on there called Careful What You Wish For, which
now that he's a local.
I know nothing about, but I will be cheering him on and be very interested to see what he's come up with. Because
if he manages to do a decent job, then we'll let him have some of the special stuff.
Yes,
at the local butchers.
Yes, League of Gentlemen reference there. Big news: we have a new Prime Minister. Does it make a difference, Ruben? Man in the street.
Have we? Oh, Julius Caesar.
Yes,
Julius Caesar. It does, of course, it does. She's a redhead.
Okay.
She's a she, and she's not a Tory.
Well, that remains to be seen.
She's less Tory than the previous one.
Again, that remains to be seen, but yeah, apparently she... Apparently she comes from the left wing of the party, but, you know...
That's true. And Bill Bailey is concerned that he actually drove her out, because he arrived in the country and they changed.
Huh?
And Bill Bailey was a bit concerned about that. And then somebody said to Bill that he was very stupid and not funny at all. So I told him not to worry. He could come to Coffs Harbour and visit me, and I would make him a kangaroo pasty to cheer him up. So it's a rather a long-winded connection there, but there you go.
Right. In which forum did you have this conversation?
He's on Twitter, and it's the first time I posted to Twitter for a very long time.
You have a Twitter account?
I do.
Tractor.
I know. I, I set the Twitter up account before Identica existed, actually. When I did my long walk a long time ago. And actually, maybe Identica did exist, but I didn't know about it.
No. The most insightful and perhaps worrying comment I heard about the change of prime ministership came from Laura Tingle, the political editor in the Fin Review, saying that this basically has set a precedent where no prime minister will be willing to take any risks anymore, because at the first sign of a dip in popularity, they're going to be out and someone else will be in. I think that I wasn't personally aware that, because I don't follow the news until a few months after it's happened, so I wasn't personally aware that Rudd had suffered a dip in popularity. And I'm wondering if perhaps it was mainly to do with the mining profit tax,
mining tax.
The associated propaganda campaign around that, which, I mean, to me, I was really encouraged by that, because it was the first sort of progressive change to the taxation system we'd seen in my lifetime. And Ken Henry at the Treasury Department seems like quite a not completely crazy bloke, which is remarkable for anyone involved in the finance side of government. I'm sure he'd be on the outer now as well, which is quite disappointing. So I thought all up, it doesn't bode well for the future. I mean, it means the...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the whether or not the Prime Minister gets booted out by their own party isn't completely dependent on their popularity. I mean, obviously, ultimately it is, but I think it's also to do with being connected with their party. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a political person. I don't follow politics that closely, but there's been plenty of leaders in the world who've taken risks, and I think it's about whether or not the party believes in them as much as the public. And obviously the party didn't believe in Kevin Rudd, so...
Well, I mean, I used to be of the opinion that it didn't really matter who was in charge, because the amount of sway that individuals within government have on what goes on is relatively small compared to the amount of sway that, say, a Kerry Packer.
And we've all seen Yes Minister.
We have.
I mean, well, maybe not all of us, but Yes Minister was, you know...
Margaret Thatcher's favourite TV programme.
Yes, it was civil servants are running the joint. I mean, look at Coffs Council.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's an interesting topic for maybe a future podcast, that argument that governments get captured by their administrators had a lot to do with the subsequent downsizing of government and deregulation of everything and re-regulation by other people who stepped in to fill the vacuum left by government.
Yeah,
but that is definitely the subject for another podcast, I think.
But you know, the whole Julia, I was going to call her Julia Rudd then, Julia Gillard thing. She's initially when I heard that she sort of stepped up to the fore, and it kind of scared me straight away, because I come from England and I spent all my childhood pretty much under Maggie Thatcher, and she was a woman with a powerful hairdo and strong character, and she had her entire party in terror of her and was a very powerful politician and completely fucked up the country. Might have bleeped that bit, sorry. She was a pretty evil woman and did some terrible things, and now they're all putting up statues for her and, you know, thinking how wonderful, you know, the left and the right. And she changed the whole political landscape so that now the left-wing party is a centrist or even right-wing, and everyone's a capitalist, and everyone, you know, capitalism won, that's what they're saying. She sort of scared me initially because of that, but then I'm an eternal optimist, so I always lay my optimistic views on top of what I hope's going to happen, and so I, you know, that's what I tend to do.
Yeah, I had a friend who during the 90s was absolutely, had an absolutely savage loathing of John Howard, and when he first came to power, I thought, you know, you're being silly, you're being naive, you know, John Howard's not going to get away with anything that the real sort of powerful elites don't want him to do, and he's going to do more or less the same job that anyone else in the same position would do. And then he went and did a whole lot of stuff that he really didn't have to do that was really nasty. And I came to realise that, yeah, the appropriating Pauline Hanson's policies, he didn't have to do that. He could have been a man of principle, but...
Well, fear, uncertainty and doubt always wins. the FUD principle, I mean, you never know what these boat people might do when they get here. We better...
And that has actually changed, like the effect that Maggie Thatcher had, just on that issue of boat people and protecting our borders, in inverted commas, which is the ultimate propaganda phrase. What a nonsensical idea, protecting your borders. They're imaginary lines.
Yes.
There's nothing there to protect. What is somebody going to do to an imaginary line?
And it's a tiny amount of people too. I mean,
it's minuscule.
You know, it's hardly any people coming in. And all the countries seem to do it. It's like they have to have this enemy to fear, to make everyone go, you know, I need to protect my home. And it's like humans have to have a black and a white, and so the government, by making these people seem like they're the black, can then say, and if you're with us, you're on the good side.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what it is. It's about being able to say, look, over there, they're evil, but where we are, we're good. And the opposition are over there too. Well, they're pandering to them, and so I guess that's what it's about, isn't it? I mean, it's
well, going back to Maggie Thatcher, one of the changes that she made was the Thatchers, Reagans, Hawkes and Keatings of that era made was to sell the idea that government wasn't about politics. It was about being a good manager, a good economic manager. And one of the things that worried me about Julia Gillard was that was practically the first thing that came out of her mouth when she acquired or seized the prime ministership was... people want me to be a good manager, and that's what I'm going to do. And that's not what I want at all. I want you to tell me what your beliefs are, what you plan to do, and you know, why you're different from somebody else. And if I happen to agree with you, then I'll vote for you. But just saying there's no difference between me and the next guy and the next guy and the next guy, except I'll do what they do better than they do it.
As long as you've all got good KPIs, I guess is all right,
yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, you know, are you keeping to your KPIs?
My
performance indicators.
My key performance indicators are things like, do I have my pants on before the first meeting I have of the day? And
well, that's where it's headed. I mean,
have I finished breakfast by lunchtime?
It's interesting because I like I said, I took my son to the local school to, you know, see about enrolling him, and they had a woman come up from the Department of Education to give a little talk about, you know, how important filling out forms was. I think that was the general thrust of her little talk.
Mm-hmm.
And she really reminded me of a character from Harry Potter. Alison would know.
That woman from the Ministry of whatever.
Yes, the Ministry of Magic.
Okay.
But she's from the Ministry of the Absurd. She likes to talk about the forms. Anyway, they gave us a 14-page form which we have to fill out, and it feels like I'm about to throw my son to the devil. You know, I've got this fucking great wad of paperwork, and they want to know everything about him. You know, and it just feels like I'm putting a silicon chip on my dog and giving him up. But, you know, he's 15 now, so, and he wants to do it, so.
Well, that's what Ken Robinson talked about in his last TED Talk from this year, the competition to get kids into the right kindergarten.
People are being interviewed for it at three. Kids sitting in front of unimpressed panels, you know, with their resumes. Flicking through it, saying, what, this is it? You've been around for 36 months and this is it? You know, you've... you've achieved nothing. I mean, it's... spent the first 6 months breastfeeding, what I can say. It's...
so...
yeah, it's a bit disturbing. You only have to talk to me for one evening in the pub to know that I'm dreadful fear of my life of turning into a Franz Kafka cockroach. You know, being drowned in this grim castle that is the bureaucracy. And this is something they were talking about in the left brain, right brain discussion I was hearing about, how bureaucracy is really just an excuse to not think about an issue. It's just a way of outsourcing the thinking.
You know, there are steps to complete, and once you've completed
the
steps...
Should my child go to that school? And if he was to go and talk to the headmaster would say, oh, he seems like a reasonable chap, and he, you know, he's not spitting on my feet, and he's, you know, he seems respectful enough, and he seems like he might be keen, and he lives locally, and yeah, he can come along. Whereas when you have to fill out a squillion forms, they make it all rely on these, you know, these number crunching and you know, yeses and nos and tick boxes and stuff. I guess my belief is that neither one of those is more reliable than the other, and I'm sure that they could produce some statistics to prove that their way was more efficient. But I don't believe it, because the efficiency is not the issue. The issue is that you're just getting on with life. We're living our lives, and there's no efficiency in that. I don't quite know what I'm saying, but it's all just about getting on with your life, really.
Yeah.
It's not about trying to win more than the next person. It's I don't know. I find it disturbing. Where we seem to be headed. What else were we going to talk about?
One thing that I thought was amusing was it the Times or the New York Times? It was one of Murdoch's. No, it must be the Times. That's Murdoch's, isn't it?
Mm.
In preparation for Murdoch's grand plan of stopping people ripping off his stuff for free, they've instituted a registration wall prior to putting in the paywall. So all you have to do in order to read the Times online is to register as a user, at this stage at least. And just the practice of introducing that has cut the readership in half, according to an article cited on Boy Boy. And I think that's really interesting. The thing about the web is that it's an almost frictionless medium. So anything that gets in the way of, oh, this looks interesting, click, and you've got it. It is like an almost infinite increase in the difficulty of getting to it.
Mm.
So never mind forking over cash, just the process of having to register as a user makes apparently half the readership say, I can't be bothered. I'll go to Google instead.
And the other thing is working as web developers, you and I both know that it's hard enough to get the administrator of the website to log on and post something.
Yeah.
Let alone to get the users, like members of our various clubs and you know, societies whose websites we host, to get the members to log in. I wouldn't even dream of doing that, because they just wouldn't do it. It's just another username password to remember.
Yeah.
Which is probably leading straight into the argument that Rupert Murdoch would probably love to have, where he would encourage everybody on the web to be registered with their real name and address and be permanently logged in as who they are, so that they can be identified wherever they are on the web, and then they can bill us.
Yeah,
I don't know. Do you remember how in the sort of early 90s, or you know, early days of the web, you used to have to, supposedly, I don't know anyone who has actually asked, but you're supposed to request permission to link to other websites.
I mean, a lot. There was always a lot of kerfuffle about establishing the social norms of what isn't acceptable. So, yeah, it took a while to sort of shake that out. But I think, you know, once Google arrived and people started working out that having other people linked to you was, you know, an unequivocal good, then that particular worry.
Not everyone's worked that out, though. That's the amazing thing. I mean, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival website has a clause, which they just took out yesterday. They had a clause in their website saying that people were not allowed to link to the website. Now, here they are trying to publicise an event, but you're not allowed to actually tell anyone about it.
Yeah.
it's like if I was to point at something, point at a, you know, a Zeppelin balloon flying over my head, I could be, you know, roused on for that and told not to do it. it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and there are still so many websites that are completely implemented in Flash.
So,
you know, pages in inverted commas on the site do not you can't
even directly, if they begged you to link to them, you couldn't do it.
You can't directly link to them, which completely defeats, you know, one of the cardinal rules of the web is that everything has an address. Everything can be linked to,
Well, I mean, when I started to study a computer course at the local technical college, thinking I might formalise my computer knowledge, I gave it in because one of the things they asked me to do was to build a website in Microsoft Word, which was challenging. I can't do that, sorry.
What's your earliest memory of Doctor Who?
John Pertwee. You know, John Pertwee, who later on went on to write things like Wurzel Gummidge. But no, my first one, I'm not quite sure which of the first memories, because I remember some of the old black and white ones, because they used to show the old black and white ones with the grumpy doctor on BBC Two. My first doctor was Pertwee, and I remember sitting on the couch that we had in our dusty old living room with the dogs under your feet. The couch the Queen Victoria had once sat on, actually. We owned a very old couch. And I remember sitting on that couch holding a pillow on my lap, as millions of other kids were probably doing at the same time. And there was that hand crawling across. Remember that one? Was that Green Death?
No, that the disembodied hand was the Hand of Fear. That was an early Tom Baker.
No, it wasn't that one then. There was Maggots.
Ah, that'll be the Green Death, yep.
Well, I get them all mixed up. But I do remember Pertwee, and I remember his old banger driving around on the Major, and Maggots in a cloud field.
Yes.
And I had nightmares about those Maggots. But I remember loving it too, you know, and I saw my own son doing exactly the same thing to the new doctor, which was very rewarding. You know, you always feel like you need to instill the same terror in your own children that you had. It's only fair. so yeah, it was. Yeah, it stays with you. And I think I loved Pertwee, and I loved Tom Baker, and Tom Baker, at the end of Tom Baker, when they switched over after that, that was the end of it for me.
Okay.
I lost interest. I didn't lose interest. I still watched it in the hopes it would improve. But I think Bonnie Tyler was the... Not Bonnie Tyler. Bonnie Langford.
Bonnie Langford, yeah.
Bonnie Langford.
Easy to get the two confused.
She was the final nail in the coffin. That was the end of it for me.
Yeah, you've got to be really hardcore to sit through a Bonnie Langford performance.
It just became a sort of annoying pantomime at that stage, and I just felt like, yeah. Well, when I say nail in the coffin, I wanted to put a nail through a head. But, you know.
Well, I mean, that's...
I was becoming a disillusioned, punkish youth by then.
That's a special quality that Bonnie Langford has.
Yes. So I moved on to bigger and better things instead. So, but you know, it was very nice when it came back. I was very excited when that American one came back. You know, with that guy who was supposed to be Doctor Who with a gun and a Harley. And when I actually saw it, obviously it was disaster. You know, you just thought, oh my god, that's a terrible mistake. I hope they never make that into a series, and they didn't. Yeah. Thank God. And then I heard about the BBC trying to scrabble the rights back, and I, you know, like all the other Doctor Who fans in the world, I was sitting there, you know, crossing my fingers and hoping they'd manage it. And they did, and it was great. And you know, they came back, and that first season I thought was fantastic. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, for me, the experience of Doctor Who in Australia was, I think, very different to what it was in Britain, because in Britain it was a Saturday evening ritual.
Yep, it's raining outside, it's dark, rainy, and what do you do? Yeah.
And in Australia it was on at 6:30 PM opposite Neighbours, so you're either a Doctor Who watcher or a Neighbours watcher, and never the twain shall meet. Mm. But in also, like the goodies, Doctor Who was just repeated by the ABC round and round and round and round and round, so the things that were only shown once in Britain and never seen again, we had the opportunity to learn them word for word. And when I was a kid, when I was a very young kid, I thought nothing of Doctor Who. It was just, you know, it was just a bit too weird and a bit unintelligible to a very young child. But I remember distinctly staying with my grandparents in the holidays, and they had a black and white portable television in the spare room.
Best kind of TV, I think.
For some reason, I found myself watching Doctor Who, and I think I just hit the right age, and I thought, my God, this is the greatest thing ever. I absolutely love this. It was a Tom Baker one, and actually, it's one I would really not think much of now. It was the Power of Kroll. It was a late Tom Baker one. When the show wasn't taking itself very seriously, and it was all a bit silly. But as a kid, I thought, wow, this guy is fantastic. And I still think I want to grow up to be Tom Baker to this day.
Yes, Tom Baker was very charismatic. My now 15-year-old son, Evan, he said to me just a few weeks ago, actually, I was watching an old Doctor Who with my youngest son, and Evan came in and said, what are you watching? And I said, oh, it's Doctor Who with Tom Baker. And he said, oh, Tom Baker, he's the one with that fantastic grin.
Yes.
I said, yep, that's the one. And I just thought, that's, you know, you couldn't miss a grin like that. He's quite insane. I actually think that there's been some great influence there in the future with all the other Doctors. I think they probably picked them on their grins. I mean, look at them. Look at them. We'll have to put this on the podcast post, okay. Podcast past even, of the just get a still of each of the grins.
I suppose yes. I suppose that's probably a good indicator of a doctor's success. When you said that, I thought, well, Colin Baker. Rotten grin. As far as I know, he wasn't capable of more than a smirk, to be honest.
The three doctors after Tom Baker don't count. They were rubbish.
I'll leave that dispute for later. But for me, this was absolutely fantastic. And as a child, I was an avid reader, and I was just getting past the age where I could get away with reading the Famous Five. It just wasn't doing it for me anymore. And at that stage, the Doctor Who novelizations were, there was something like 70 of them, and I just started consuming those at the rate of one a day, because they're not very challenging reads, no, but they're entertaining. And in the days before VHS, that was the only chance you got to repeatedly relive an episode until the next time the ABC repeated it.
Yeah, that's right. I was just looking at the names of them all. I've forgotten them all. David Tennant, he didn't have a particularly good grin. I'm just thinking about the grins here.
I was listening to you about the grinometer. Okay.
You see, there's we're going from Tom Baker. as Peter Davison. Now, he had a fairly good grin, but he was the beginning of the end. Colin Baker, well, forget about him. Sylvester McCoy was just a gollywog. I don't know. He couldn't grin. He was a silly man.
He matured into the role as he progressed.
I didn't give him the chance.
Yeah.
Paul McGann could have done it if he hadn't have been with an American production company. I reckon. Yeah. I think he could have been.
Could have been an excellent doctor.
But unfortunately, he didn't tear up the script when he should have.
Yes.
Christopher Eccleston, the grin was back on. He has a big toothy mad grin. He was great, but he didn't want to be typecast, and he didn't want a career either, so he quit, and now he works in Tesco's. And David Tennant was just a hysterical girly. He just screamed the whole time, but he had a grin.
He did have a grin, a fairly effective one.
He did, yeah. And that's he rode on the grin. And Matt Smith, well, you know, he's doing pretty good. I think Matt Smith plays a good old man.
He does.
For the youngest Doctor Who, he's a very good old man.
Yeah. I get the suspicion that Stephen Moffat's favourite Doctor is Peter Davison. And I see a lot of Peter Davison in Matt Smith's performance. I'm sure it's not deliberate, because unlike Tennant, I think Matt Smith is not a dyed-in-the-wool encyclopedic knowledge of Doctor Who fan.
Bonnie Langford was a redhead. Maybe he's trying to fix it. Maybe he's just rewound it back to Peter Davison and said, now we can make this work.
Well, certainly through the 80s, the show didn't get the treatment that it deserved from the BBC. And that is partly due to, I think, the influence of Maggie again, the Baroness Margaret Thatcher.
I blame the government.
Yeah, I blame the government. But the BBC went from being, in the 50s and 60s, a place where talent was nurtured, and it was generally accepted that, you know, you'd take people in off the streets and train them how to make television, to in the 80s they scaled things back to the point where the BBC just produced nothing in-house except for news and sport, and everything else was farmed out to independent production companies.
You outsource everything. That's what the 80s was all about.
So by the time, by the mid 80s, Doctor Who was the only drama produced in-house in the BBC.
It was actually a shit time to leave school, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
The 80s. I mean, I remember leaving school. So I'm digressing a little bit from Doctor Who, I'm sorry, but you leave school in the mid to late 80s, and all you read about in the newspapers and hear about in the news is the yuppies and how much money the yuppies are making. And then you go as a gormless school leaver to find a job, and the yuppies are the ones who are going to employ you, and they're going to pay you nothing. So a TARDIS would have been good at that stage, but unfortunately the yuppies had stuffed that up too, so
yeah,
they got us good there. Which is why it's so good now, my kids get to watch Doctor Who.
So I mean, the show started in those Halcyon days of the early 60s. The BBC had a guy called Sidney Newman, who was the head of drama, who basically came up with the concept for the show. But in his conception, the show was to be aimed at, in his words, intelligent 14-year-olds. And it was supposed to have a certain amount of educational value. You know,
I bet it was intelligent 14-year-old boys.
I expect so.
This was
the
60s.
And the idea was you'd get your history lessons from going back in time, and you get your science lessons sort of
going forwards in time,
it's and so on and so forth. And
well, when you look at those old William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton ones, they draw from the classics a lot.
Well, the BBC did a lot of costume drama, and that meant that you could get your costumes rather cheap because they'd already been manufactured for another production. It was the monsters and alien planets and so on that was expensive.
But tinfoil and plastic was futuristic back then.
Yes. Also, black and white made things a lot easier. It's harder to make a convincing alien world in colour with upturned plant pots and things like that.
Yes.
But as far as being a series with sombre educational value, that was kind of thrown out the window by the second story, which introduced the Daleks. The first episode of Doctor Who actually stands up rather well as a piece of television drama. You can watch it now and not cringe with embarrassment. but the bug-eyed monsters that came in after the Daleks that Sidney Newman so desperately wanted to avoid, some of those stories haven't aged quite so well.
I liked Patrick Troughton. I always wanted eyebrows like him.
Let's try the grinometer out on a few people.
Patrick Troughton, definitely. He's a winner. He has eyebrows to go with the go with the grin.
Yeah. William Hartnell.
He had the Skeletor grin.
He was quite a well-established actor. He was in a film called This Sporting Life.
Oh my God, you have done your research, haven't you?
I know this off by heart. I'm almost as bad as Tennant at this stuff. But he played, I think, a football manager in This Sporting Life. I've never seen it, but it is one of those classic sort of gritty 50s films. And he was also known for playing Sergeant Majors and whatnot. He was also in a couple of Carry On films. But Patrick Troughton was actually one of the first actors to specialise in television, whereas most actors had, you know, would come from stage and screen and do a bit of television but regarded as a bit sort of beneath them.
Yeah.
Patrick Troughton was rather fond of saying, who on earth would want to spend every night shouting? So he liked being home in bed nice and early,
and he was a cheeky chappy too, wasn't he? I mean, he was very impish, and
he was a fantastic character actor, it has to be said. I saw him in the 80s in an episode of All Creatures Great and Small, and it was not until the credits rolled that I recognised him. He played a grizzled old Yorkshire farmhand, all sort of wiry, looking a bit like Robbie Coltrane in the Harry Potter films. and he was utterly unrecognisable. And I think that was the first time that, as a child, I actually appreciated what it was that actors did. Well, certainly character actors. It was quite an amazing transformation. And actually, his performance in Doctor Who is pretty well judged too, although I don't think most of his stories were particularly good. He was kind of known as the Monster Doctor.
Yes.
So
yes, when I think of him, I always think of him with the tinfoil.
Yeah.
Oh, and those terrible Cybermen with like a funnel on their heads. They look like a tin man out of the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. One year they'd acquired a machine for making foam, so every monster that year was some kind of foamy beast.
But you know, if I had a TARDIS and I could go and get any job in the world, I would go back and work in the sound. There was the BBC organisation who.
The Radiophonics
Workshop. That was when I was a kid.
That's what you wanted to do.
That's what I remember watching Doctor Who and listening to the soundtrack, of course, and thinking how wonderfully scientific it was, and then discovering that the Radiophonic Workshop was responsible for these incredible sounds. You know, these boing, 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 you know, and spooky effects. And then I think I might have seen an interview with somebody from the Radiophonic Workshop on Blue Peter, which was, you know, obviously where I got all my knowledge from.
That would be Dick Mills, I expect.
No doubt. I wouldn't even remember, because unfortunately I suffer from memory loss. Yeah. I live in the present. And I thought that'd be great. Even now I think it would be great. I'd love to just go around with my little sound recorder and just record odd sounds.
And speed them up, slow them down, play them backwards, just and see what you got.
Like a squirrel farting, turning it into Darth Vader's laser beam, you know, and stuff like that. It'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
In fact, maybe one day I can, you know, work with you on one of your movies, and I can do the special sound effects for you, and I feel like I've finally achieved my aim in life.
Okay.
We call it the Rubiophonic Workshop. Maybe Doctor Who will come looking for me to work on the next series, you know.
Like, yeah. I'll try and talk someone into writing a science fiction script that...
It doesn't have to be science fiction. It just could be...
Just something with a lot of weird sounds.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't have to be... I'd like to play around with sound. It'd be interesting. It'd have to be weird. I'll tell you what, just as a practice run, I'll go home tonight, tomorrow, this weekend. Mm-hmm. I shall produce an interesting sound for you, and you can add it in just here.
Sounds rather like a threat. Okay. One interesting sound by Ruben. Ta-da! The other thing about the black and white doctors is that a huge amount of their stories don't exist because the BBC thought, who the hell would want to watch repeats, and reused the tape.
They should have thrown away the ones with Paul McGann, Sylvester McCoy, Colin Baker, and the final years of Peter Davison.
Okay. I would say the middle year of Peter Davison. And in Australia, the ABC would not repeat anything that wasn't in colour, because who on earth would want to watch any black and white? So I never saw any black and white Doctor Who until quite late in the 80s. The ABC did a couple of run-throughs of repeating all the stories that existed in full, and that's when I got to see some of the early things that people had raved about in Doctor Who fandom, which subsequently turned out to be not quite as impressive as I'd been led to believe.
They're always better in print, aren't they? Or in your memories.
Which was part of the joy of the novelisations, because it frequently gave the author of the script a chance to render it as it should have been done, rather than
as a rustling tinfoil man wading through a lake. Lolly.
Yeah. So subsequently, I'm not that familiar with Patrick Troughton's work as a doctor, because very little of it exists. But I did fairly recently see Tomb of the Cybermen for the first time, and that actually stands up pretty well. Probably famous for the scene where hibernating Cybermen burst out of their little cryogenic chambers and look terribly scary. At this stage too, the word regeneration had not been coined, so it's really uncertain exactly what's going on with the lead actors changing all the time. But at the end of Patrick Troughton's gig, the story was that he was banished to Earth by his own people, and as part of his punishment he would be forced to change his appearance.
I do remember that plot device, and I always quite liked it, because I don't know, it explained a lot, you know, why John Pertwee was tearing around in some nutty old car with the Major.
The Brigadier.
Brigadier, was he?
Yeah.
Well, I always thought it was the Major. But yes, I did quite like that, and it seems to have disappeared, and now the Doctor's become quite attached to the Earth and just does it because out of the kindness of his heart and hangs around. So, and his people seem to have, you know, disappeared into some time bubble somewhere they might never come back from. I'm not quite sure if they've gone forever. Just like everything in Doctor Who, you're never quite sure if it's all gone forever. In fact, you know perfectly well that it's never gone forever. They're always going to call back on them when the ratings demand it.
Yeah.
Like those fucking Daleks. When will the Daleks die? I mean,
I was really pleased when Russell T. Davies came up with a plot of, there's been a Time War, and the whole of the Time Lord race, except for the Doctor, and all of the Daleks have just been wiped off the face of the universe.
I remember having this conversation with
and,
you.
And I thought that was terrific.
Clean slates, yes.
Because it gets rid of that whole Trainspotter thing and gives you the chance to just make the story about quirky guy in a blue box.
The Daleks in the war, you know, the Ironsides, my Ironsides, and he's Churchill and all that lot. And at the end of the episode, the Daleks burst out of their light box thing where they've been created as upgrades. And it just reminded me of a Spice Girls reunion concert. They were all in multicolor, only they were all obese Spice Girls made of Dalek bumps. It was the most disappointing moment for me, that particular episode, when all those sort of rotund, oversized Daleks wobbled out from their little box.
Yeah.
You thought, oh God, there's more of them.
Well, the disappointing thing for me but we're getting ahead of ourselves with that episode, was the total waste of Bill Paterson, the eminent Scottish actor.
Oh, yes, yes,
who,
yes.
Who is absolutely marvellous, but didn't have a lot to do except...
I'm hoping he's going to turn up again, though.
Yeah.
But sorry, you said we're getting ahead of ourselves. Did you want to go through all of them?
We could zip through all the Doctors and say a few things about them. John Pertwee was my first proper Doctor because his episodes were in colour.
And he reversed the polarity on a lot of things.
He reversed the polarity of the neutron flow and had established many clichés of the series.
He was the techno nerd one, wasn't he? He had all the gadgets.
Yeah. And
cars.
Well, Pertwee himself was gadget mad and car mad and loved all that. To me, the classic period of Doctor Who starts with Pertwee's last season, basically because a writer who'd been with the show since Patrick Troughton's era, Robert Holmes, was taking over as script editor. And Russell T Davies has said Robert Holmes was one of the great unacknowledged screenwriters of the 20th century. He was only the incoming sort of script editor. He's sort of trailing Terrence Dix around in the last series, but I rather suspect that he had quite a hand in the last series of John Pertwee's tenure, because the stories were really solid.
I'm trying to remember the stories, and I'm just...
So we're talking things like... let me see. The time... coincided with Sarah Jane. Sarah Jane's appearance. And one of the great
I always fancied Sarah Jane. She was nice.
Tell me about it. But, well, I mean, one of the great tragedies about the fact that she got her own spin-off series was that the spin-off series was essentially aimed at kids. It was like the anti-Torchwood, whereas Torchwood was like the Doctor Who for grown-ups. The Sarah Jane Adventures was the Doctor Who for kids. I think they kind of... They didn't do Liz Sladen, the actress, a lot of justice in that, because she was... absolutely fantastic as Sarah Jane, not only in the I'm a 14-year-old boy and fancy the hell out of her stakes, but she's a magnificent actress in the DVD extras for The Time Warrior, which was her first story.
Okay.
The producer, Barry Letts, said they auditioned loads and loads of women for the role. And he said all of them could act scared and all of them could act brave, but only Liz could do both at once. And that was her sort of forte, the I'm as scared as anything, but I'm going to jolly well do this.
What's this? She was found within bowshot company.
Idiots! Why did you stop this ridiculous pantomime?
Well, she spits fire, eh, blood axe? Come here, girl.
Get lost. Ooh.
He wears gold blood axe.
Hurt, you fool!
You call I am grown a fool? I'll have the marrow from your bones, my little chicken. Where are you from?
Look, just pack this up, will you? It's not funny. I happen to be a reporter, and I've got a big story.
Take it away, blood axe, throw it in the dungeon.
Why don't you take off that ridiculous gear and go home to your butcher's shop? Let go! Look, I warn you, any more of this, and I'm going straight to the police.
And, certainly in comparison to a lot of the actresses that preceded her, she just really took it to another level.
As you were saying that, I was actually just remembering The Brain of Morbius, which was an episode I loved, mainly because I remember being so utterly terrified of this brain gurgling away in a jar. And having my older brothers point out to me that, you know, all the faults in the set, you know, how it's just wobbling and it's not really a real brain. But, you know, when you're caught up in the moment...
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
You hear the music and Sarah Jane is acting brave and scared. It's excellent stuff.
Yeah.
Good drama.
John Pertwee definitely went out on a high note. Planet of the Spiders, which... is one of those stories that everybody remembers, the giant spiders.
Is that fear? I can feel in your mind. You are not accustomed to feeling frightened, are you, Doctor? You are very wise to be afraid of me.
I do remember the spiders. I don't remember the plot of these things. Yeah. I just remember hiding behind the sofa. Quite often, I would get told to go to bed because I think I was annoying everyone because I was so scared and loving it. And I got to see that again. Sorry, moving forward again with my own kids. I keep going on about them, but Emrys and I were watching the finale of the Doctor Who the other night, and I felt like sending him to bed because he was driving me insane. But at the same time, I knew how he felt because I remembered feeling the same way.
Mm.
And he was jumping around and so excited, you know, and laughing and shouting and, you know, just really enjoying himself.
Mm.
And kids got treated differently in the old days.
John Pertwee left on a high note.
Yep.
And I don't remember the changeover.
Well, Tom Baker's first story was a bit of an anticlimax. I thought it was very, the story was very weak, and it was sort of outgoing script editors, Terence Dix, as he'd always wanted to write a story that was, well, like the brain of Morbius was Terence Dix's go at Frankenstein. Robot, Tom Baker's first story, was his go at King Kong. And the story was terribly weak, but the story after that, The Ark in Space, absolutely established Tom Baker as, oh my God, this guy's fantastic. And the story was deeply, deeply, deeply scary. It was a Robert Holmes script. Do you remember the Wirren, the giant bugs? Laid their eggs in dormant humans in this satellite in space.
Yes, vaguely remember this one.
Right there.
I've got a picture of of the props and the you know the space station and then running up and down white corridors.
but yeah, it was a marvelous story and one of those ones where Tom Baker was just fresh to the show and he was really giving it his all and not hamming it up and not sort of...
Because he did ham it up a lot later on, didn't he? And that got a bit annoying at
towards
times.
The end, I felt that he was either hamming it up or phoning it in or both at the same time. But early on, he was really treating it as a serious performance. And he's a fascinating person who you could do a whole podcast on.
My trade, such as it is to try to be convincing. And the more preposterous the situation or the script, then the more interesting it is to try to be convincing. You know, if you're playing a realistic thing of a man with a gun, that can't be difficult. But to play someone from outer space, a benevolent alien, but who still looks like a human being, and who has secrets, how do you suggest that he is alien? And so I felt the best way to suggest that I was an alien and came from somewhere else and had secrets, dark thoughts and wonderful thoughts, I thought the way to do that is just to be Tom Baker.
One of the times that they were getting it right with the whole idea that this man's an alien, he's not human.
Mm.
And then that
was very important, I think, to Tom Baker's approach to how he did it, to treat it as absolutely real. He really is an alien, and there are times when that's going to be a bit unsettling. So yeah, from that point on, for the next few seasons, the show entered what's commonly called its gothic phase. So things were, you know, quite dark. You had things like, as you say, the Brain of Morbius, which was a Frankenstein ripoff. Seeds of Doom, which was rather like a John Wyndham, Triffids type thing with plants that eat people.
Yes, and I was very keen on John Wyndham when I was watching Doctor Who. I think that was my mum encouraged that. She used to buy me John Wyndham novels for my birthday and stuff. And yes, I mean Doctor Who was what sort of made got me reading all the science fiction I read when I was an early teenager.
Mm.
Yes, it's interesting to see all the different influences there, and you know, because you can you realise it's not just Doctor Who that's talking about this. It's there's they're just taking their ideas from
all over the place.
Yeah.
So I mean, yeah. Also in that era in Tom Baker's first year was Genesis of the Daleks, which is another classic, where it's sort of finally sort of explicitly pointed out that the Daleks are a metaphor for the Nazis. So there were a few sort of vintage years there.
I find it amazing, but, actually, that you've got it all sequentially in your head here. You see, for me, the Doctor Who has always been something I watched when I was a kid, and I have very fond memories of it, and I was influenced by it, but I don't actually have any. I guess I haven't looked back and analysed it since.
Well, the first, I was saying to someone the other day, the first serious academic book I ever read was a book called Doctor Who, The Making of a Television Series, by a couple of guys, I cannot remember their names, but it was the first book I ever read that had sort of fully annotated. I kept having to flick to the back of the book to, you know, see what the footnotes were about, yeah. And I thought, this is very tiresome. But it was one of those things that started to make you think about, you know, how this is actually done, and as well as that, the sort of growing fandom that sort of started to spring up in the late Tom Baker's era, and the amount of fanzines and the sort of critical reviews of the story and the sort of all the behind the scenes things that started taking off, and certainly during the 80s the fanzines started getting very professionally produced. And in fact there's a magazine on newsstands now called Dreamwatch, a science fiction magazine,
yeah.
Which started which before it was called Dreamwatch was called Dreamwatch Bulletin. Before that it was called Doctor Who Bulletin, but they had to change their name because the BBC objected. So in order to
keep publishing,
they thought, well, okay, we'll change our name to something different, but it'll still be DWB, and we'll just chuck in the odd story about Star Trek. And that started out as a you know, photocopied fanzine, but very quickly became very professional.
I mean, Doctor Who. Is a great jumping off point for, I mean, I bet there's tons of electronic enthusiasts, scientists, people who study the classics. You know, a lot of people have probably been inspired by Doctor Who in lots of ways.
Oh, I know. I certainly got, as a teenager, I got very into the sort of cutting edge science stuff, the Carl Sagan-y sort of popular science publications, because of Tom Baker's last season. The guy who took over from Douglas Adams, I believe. Yes, the guy who took over from Douglas Adams as script editor was a guy called Christopher H. Bidmead, who was I believe, I'm not going to look up on Wikipedia because we have our fact-checking policy in place. I believe he was a science journalist before, as well as a fiction writer, before taking the job on Doctor Who. And that was a deliberate policy where the series had gotten a bit silly in Tom Baker's later years, and that kind of accelerated under Douglas Adams. And I'm not fully in sync with, I think, the majority of fans, but I think Douglas Adams did not do his best work while on Doctor Who, because at the same time he was writing Series 2 of the Hitchhiker's Radio Show.
He was
radio
a very busy
show.
Man when he was doing Doctor Who, yeah. And he wasn't at his happiest, I don't think, at that stage.
So when a new production team came in 1980, they said, right, we're putting an end to all this seriousness, it's going to be back to basics, the science is going to be kind of, not real science, but kind of,
well, you know,
somewhat plausible
maybe this,
science.
Maybe this says something about you know, about us, because I mean, I don't really remember that very well, but I do remember being very disappointed when, actually, not immediately. I wasn't immediately disappointed with Peter Davidson.
That's the trouble with regeneration. You never quite know what you're going to get.
But fairly soon, you know. I think, like I say, Bonnie Langford was the final nail, but it was going down. I wasn't happy with the change. I really enjoyed the episode with the Mona Lisa, and that was Tom Baker, wasn't it?
The one with the Mona Lisa was Tom Baker one, which was co-written by Douglas Adams.
Yes,
and
I knew Douglas Adams had a hand in that one, and it stopped halfway
Graham
through.
Williams.
I remember it was I was really. They were in Oxford University.
You're thinking of two different stories, both very similar in tone. The one with the Mona Lisa was set in Paris, and that was co-written by Douglas Adams and Graham Williams, the producer. And I think because at the time because the BBC had a policy that script editors couldn't write for the series that they were script editing on, it went out under a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
But that was definitely a Douglas Adams script. And there was a later one, which was the last one that Douglas Adams and Graham Williams worked on, called Sharda.
That's right, Sharda. That was the one that stopped halfway through, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. A strike at the BBC stopped filming. And as I said, when the new production team took over in 1980, they could have picked it up. And
I remember
because
at the time we all wanted to watch Doctor Who the following week. Me and my brothers, you know, we're very keen to see the next episode. Back in the days when I actually would remember what was on telly and look forward to it, and of course it wasn't. My sister was reading the Radio Times saying that it's not on, it'll be on next week. And the next week we looked again, and there was the football or something pointless, and yeah, it never came around. And I was very disappointed about that.
Shorter season than usual in 1979.
But I've heard that since they've reassembled it, and they've made a...
They put it out on video. I can't remember if it came out on VHS or DVD, but...
But yeah, it'll be on the internet.
The way that they used to do things in Doctor Who was they'd do all the location filming for a story ahead of time, and then the studio stuff they'd do in two-episode blocks back-to-back, so... For the normal four-parter, they'd do episodes 1 and 2 in one lot, and then 3 and 4 in the other. So basically for Sharda, they had all the location filming done. They had, I think, pretty much all of the studio stuff for episodes 1 and 2, except maybe some things that they had to pick up. And then as you go through episodes 3 and 4, the DVD has an increasing amount of linking commentary by Tom Baker to the point where at the end it's just... being read to you, basically.
Yeah. Oh well.
Sad, but because the incoming production team said we're getting rid of all this old sort of flippant, sort of self-parodying style, they chose not to continue on.
Oh well. It's...
But it was definitely the end of an era. But there was some good stories in Tom Baker's last season, especially Warrior's Gate, which was one of those what the hell is going on here stories that I absolutely love. You can watch 20 times and it's deliberately ambiguous what's going on, and it's 20 years later it's still debatable exactly what the story
is
about.
They loved doing that back in the 80s, that stuff. They I think they thought it was very intellectual.
Yeah
When in actual fact it was often quite annoying.
Yeah. And well, in fact, in Peter Davison's first season, the story that this book I read, Doctor Who, The Making of the Television Series, the story that they mainly concerned themselves with as an example of how it's made was the story Kinder from Peter Davison's first series, which had Richard Todd, quite an eminent English actor, and Neris Hughes from The Liver Birds as guest stars, as well as that chap who's on the bill, whose name I cannot remember. But fantastic story, and again, it was all sort of psychological. And yeah, it's the sort of stuff I love, but probably contributed in no small degree to the audience figures dropping off throughout the 80s, because it really requires some dedication in you couldn't come in at episode 3 and sort of work out what had gone on previously.
Mm.
But I thought Peter Davison was an excellent Doctor who didn't get the chance that he deserved.
You're actually making me want to go and try and track these down. Mm. I noticed they've got some Doctor Who video cassettes at the local library.
Okay.
So I'll have to go and have a look now.
They've got some of the old novelizations too at the Village Favourites bookstore/video shop.
Thinking I'd moved to the arse end of the world, yeah. But it's not at all. It's
just picking them off the shelf and looking at the covers just transported me back 20 years in time. It was just so good. But during Peter Davison's time, ironically, although the same production team led by John Nathan Turner, who was doomed to be the producer of Doctor Who for the rest of its first run, it got increasingly self-referential to the point where in the 20th anniversary season, every story deliberately had some element of the series past. So it was really made for the train spotters in the audience, and that alienated the casual viewer as well, because they were referring back to things that happened 20 years ago or something, which was really asking a lot. And I think due to the fact that the stories were riding on nostalgia, that had a lot to do with the decision by Peter Davison to quit after only 3 years. But his last story as well was an absolute cracker.
Doctor! Unlock this door! What are you doing in there?
Have you been open this door or not?
Ah, Stutzy, have you had a good rest?
Damn you, Doctor, open this door!
Sorry, it seems to be locked.
Come on, go get the cutting gear.
Now listen, Doctor, be reasonable. This won't do you any good.
Stutzy, we'll be touching down in a couple of minutes, or more likely crashing down, you see. I'm a bit out of practice with manual landing, so if I were you, I'd find something firm to hang on to.
I'll murder you when I get in there, Doctor!
The only director to have worked on the original series and the new one.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, it all went a bit wrong.
Doctor?
You're expecting someone else?
I...
That's three eyes in one breath. Makes you sound a rather egotistical young lady.
What's happened?
Change, my dear. And it seems on a moment too soon.
It did, yeah, yeah.
It's debatable whether Colin Baker, Peter Davison's successor, was just fundamentally miscast or just couldn't act, or whether, you know, the scripts he was getting were not good enough or whatever. But also the show was under attack from Mary Whitehouse.
Really? It was under attack by Mary Whitehouse?
Yeah.
What on earth for?
The excessive violence and gore and blood and guts and whatever.
She must be dead now, surely.
Yeah, I believe she is.
She would have died from apoplectic terror, yeah. Wouldn't she, from what's on telly nowadays?
Yeah. But this tendency to wallowing in the series history and also the just sheer unlikability of Colin Baker's Doctor really turned off a lot of people. And the series was put on hiatus for 18 months. And when it came back...
I remember this. When it came back, I was so excited. I thought, oh, God, they're going to fix it.
Yeah.
Finally, they're going to fix it.
They
imagine my disappointment.
They brought it back, and I've probably got it tucked away in a cardboard box somewhere, but there was the Doctor Who bulletin, the front page, announced... the headline was... In 1963, There were the first season of Doctor Who had 44 episodes. In 1986, it's going to have 14. So
after the 19 song,
yeah,
yes, hilarious.
But the BBC clearly had it in for Doctor Who. They brought it back very reluctantly, and it was dodgy.
They killed it.
They made the mistake of this return series. They made the mistake of giving it an overarching sort of plot. The trial of a Time Lord.
I can't believe you even knew that. I think I've watched the first two episodes and gave up.
Yeah. Well, they made many mistakes in that series. They had an overarching plot which demanded that that viewers watch the whole 14 episodes in order for them to make sense. They still had Colin Baker being just as unlikable, and they introduced Bonnie Langford. So...
Moment silence, please.
Yes.
Death of Doctor Who.
For the next season, season 24, Colin Baker was not asked back. And they gave the role to Sylvester McCoy, who up until then was principally famous for putting ferrets down his trousers. He was in something called the Ken Campbell Roadshow. Am I correct in that?
I don't remember. I'd grown out of it by then. I think I decided that it was... Langford was the final nail.
On one of those Secret Policeman's Ball videos that the Amnesty International comedy fundraising videos, there's the Ken Campbell Roadshow featuring Sylvester McCoy running around like mad in a kilt, tied up in a straitjacket, while a midget sends a toy train with a fork stuck to the front of it, prongs out, sends a toy train along a track aimed at McCoy's genitals.
You know, that
while he tries to get
familiar
out of the straitjacket. And the other special talent of McCoy was hammering nails into his head.
His nose.
Yeah.
I think you've seen that.
Yeah. So, inauspicious. Nobody expected very much. But I have to say that once they'd gotten rid of Bonnie Langford, the series started finding its feet again. And it was really just the fact that the BBC just had whittled it down to the point where so few people still cared about it, that despite having a pretty solid last two seasons, they could get rid of it finally.
Yeah, it's very sad. But then it came back.
Yep, as a television movie with Paul McGann.
Oh, okay, well, just forget that one. That didn't happen. And then it came back.
And it didn't suck.
No, it didn't suck. That first season was brilliant, actually. I mean, The Empty Child was a classic. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
I always like it when Doctor Who goes into the war. One of the great wars, generally the Second World War. You know, they've got Spitfires. It all gets a bit British though, which is can get a bit tiresome. But it's.
Did you download the leaked version of Rose when it first came out onto the internet?
Rose,
the first episode of the new series.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Everyone did, didn't they?
Yeah.
Oh, except I would never do anything illegal, of course.
No, heavens no.
But if I did, I would have.
I had been of the opinion, and the Paul McGann movie certainly cemented that opinion, that the old days were gone. The BBC had just changed so much that it was just not possible to make Doctor Who anymore.
When the Paul McGann one came out, I think I can't remember where I watched that, but I remember being very sad about that and thinking, well, that's never going to see Doctor Who again.
Yeah.
No, they're never going to produce more Doctor Who, is what I thought. But they did.
Yeah, so despite being a lifelong fan, I did not read anything in anticipation of the resurrected series. I didn't have any particular expectations that it was going to be any good. And just the fact that it didn't suck was... it absolutely delighted me. And as it went on, finding that it was actually staying true to the spirit of the original series was very satisfying. One of the things Russell T. Davies said in one of the Doctor Who confidentials was that his greatest satisfaction was bringing it back and showing people how brilliant the show was. Because you can look at it now and think, well, you know, this is the modern version. The old one was all wobbly sets and kind of dry and uninteresting. But if you go back and look at a story like The Green Death or some of the Sarah Jane ones, certainly, it's got that emotional... The emotional content was always there. It's just that when you're a 12-year-old child, you don't see it.
Yes, I mean, that's the big difference between, say, Doctor Who and something like Babylon 5. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but there's an American science fiction series called Babylon 5. And it's all CGI and soap opera, basically. It feels like it's out of a tin can. Or even like a cop drama, you know? Whereas Doctor Who, you feel like he's a good man, and he wants people to be good too. And he's trying to... No, there's a moral. He's making moral decisions, and he's just trying to be a moral person, which I think is a wonderful thing to have on television. You know, but also what you were saying about how the new season is so good because it's trying to show people how good the old season was, which shows you how much the audience has changed. You know, people now watch television and take it seriously. When I was a kid, television was I don't think everyone took it. Like, I don't know your parents, but my parents definitely didn't take it seriously. I remember I used to come home from school and quite regularly find that my mum had hidden the 14-inch black and white TV set, or just taken the plug off it, or taken the... You know, we weren't encouraged to watch television at all. It wasn't something that was taken seriously. And if you talk about what was on TV, then it was sort of, don't you do anything else with your life, you know? Whereas now, people do talk about it. It's they recognise it as part of our culture, because it's storytelling.
Yeah.
But in England, as a child, books were far more important. And even now, it's the case that there's a bit of snobbism that, you know, books is where, you know, real stories are.
Mm.
But in actual fact, you know, real stories are on television.
Yeah.
You watch telly for... Your current culture fix.
That's certainly Josh Canal from the Box Cutters podcast. His line is that television is a new cinema, talking about, you know, the classy series that come out of American cable television, like your Sopranos or The Wire or whatever.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Box Cutters podcast, the last episode, they have a running... feature on great characters from television, and the last episode they talked about the Doctor. So check that out.
I shall. I've just downloaded that one, actually. I shall listen to that.
But yeah, I mean, one of the... You're saying about the character and how the character's essentially a moral character. It's I think in popular culture, the Doctor sort of plays the same role that, say, a Robin Hood or a King Arthur or whatever plays. It's that same sort of heroic figure.
Yes, who's slightly tortured and alone. You know, people don't understand him. But which is why 14-year-old kids would identify with him, you know, because no one understands them either.
All 14-year-old kids are aliens.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
and certainly, as I said, you know, if you're sitting in a... deep in suburbia, where everybody conforms, to see the hero being sort of wildly eccentric is tremendously inspiring.
Well, that's one of the wonderful things about the first episode of the new season, when the Doctor grabs Rose, says "Run."
Mm.
That's just very powerful, you know, because that's exactly what... As a 14-year-old, I wanted to run somewhere.
Mm.
I wasn't going to be his Rose. But, you know, I wanted to be the Doctor. I wanted to be taking off on an adventure. I didn't want to be sitting there in suburbia.
Yeah, and certainly... I mean, I can vividly remember as a kid just that feeling that around any corner there could be a Dalek or a Cyberman, and how powerfully that sort of grabbed your imagination. And I, you know, at every creative writing exercise at school was a Doctor Who story.
I think also there was something to be said for the we were going to stop talking about this, but we're still going. There's something to be said for the crappiness of the props and the sort of technical side of the, you know, like I used to watch it on a little tiny black and white set. And we've got a colour set later, obviously, but then the reception might not always be good. And I kind of like the fact that it leaves something to your imagination. Because there's always when there's bad props or a bad reception, or you know it's not a very good thing, you're still getting the narrative, the story is still coming through, and that's the important bit.
Yeah.
Because you it's like I mean I've been to plays where they're doing ridiculous things like pretending they're flying hellhounds and just flapping their arms and running around the room, you know. But if the narrative is strong enough, if the story drives, you believe it because you're willing to suspend your disbelief.
That's a great thing about most of Stephen Moffat's stories, is that the scary thing is a very ordinary thing. So like in The Empty Child,
yeah,
you know, it's a gas mask, it's a kid with a gas mask on
looking for his mum. Yeah.
And Blink, it's people dressed up as statues. And
I mean it's a great thing, because as a storyteller, really, all you need to terrify the living socks off people is the unknown. Because that's going all the way back to when we were talking about politics earlier. That's what John Howard was relying on with the Children Overboard, you know. My God, these people are monsters. They'll do things we don't understand.
Yes.
They must be... Well, call a doctor. You know, it's a very simple thing to and yet a very difficult thing, I guess, to do it well, but a very simple thing to produce a monster to scare someone. You don't need to have computer-animated special effects.
You don't need, you know, 30,000 Daleks whizzing around the sky.
No, you do not need 30,000 Daleks flapping around. Unless it's for comedic effect. they started doing some sort of formation swimming or dancing, that could be quite good.
Did you know the first television Doctor Who that Stephen Moffat ever wrote?
No. As if I'd know that.
The Curse of Fatal Death.
Oh, really?
That comic.
The farting communication one.
Yes, that.
And I had dinner with the architect 400 years ago, and.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The one where the master appears saying, "I've been enhanced with Dalek technology," and whips his hand out to reveal the sink plunger.
Yeah. No, I remember the Dalek bumps, and Joanna Lumley became the Doctor, which I've all my life have waited for Joanna Lumley to become the Doctor, because she was the logical choice. I don't know why, but it was perfect when I saw Joanna Lumley becoming the Doctor. In fact, I don't know why they didn't do it seriously. I mean, if things had worked out differently, I'm sure they would have.
Well, I actually think it's better if the Doctor is a relatively unknown actor, which is one of the things I was happy about Matt Smith, because it would be so easy to cast someone famous.
Well, apparently Matt Smith's a complete celebrity in England now. He's got his own radio show and he's on all kinds of things.
He would be now, yeah.
Well, yeah, he's now. Oh, good on him.
Yep.
You know the pub?
Thank you, Doc.
I'll buy you a beer.
Right, yeah.
Have to wash down that slug poison I just gave you.
That was actually quite palatable.
Oh, thank you very much. It's very green. It's not quite ripe.
It was a bit... It looked a bit...
I've been carrying it around all evening, so...
It looked a bit like Louisiana seawater, but it tasted fine.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So I think that's right. You try saying something. So
I don't know what to say now. You've told me to say something. I can slurp my beer very loudly. How about that? Will that do?